Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. On this podcast today, we have the honor of talking to three very well-known cybersecurity professionals. The theme of our show will be about COVID-19, the trends that we've noticed, and what could the future hold for the rest of this year. We are talking with Mr. Tim Keeler, the founder and CEO of Remediant, Mr. Patrick Peterson, the founder of Agari, and Mr. Caleb Kwong. He's the CEO and founder of Savant Solutions. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
My pleasure. Excited for the conversation.
Yeah. Could each one of you go and get started? Could you kind of each one of you share about your bio and how you kind of got started in cybersecurity and how you actually started your companies? I believe each and every one of you founded your own company, so I'm correct, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That is correct.
So, Caleb, why don't you go ahead and get started, please?
Sure, go ahead. So just going to give you a little background about where I started. I've been in working in the federal and prime contractor space for over a decade now, really working with the DoD, helping them secure their air gap environments. And over the years, I saw a trend happening where security was becoming more and more important. And so what I decided to do was focus really for the last now 4 years really in the security space, especially with the surge in attacks that's really happening. So I felt like I could do my part to kind of help protect my customers in this digital age right now to help them make them as secure as possible. I mean, the threat's increasing and it's not slowing down anytime soon. So that's kind of where I got my start.
Okay, excellent. Tim, can you please go ahead and kind of introduce to the audience your background, your bio, and how you got started in cybersecurity, and how you founded Remediant, please?
Yeah, so, I've been doing cybersecurity for just over 20 years now. I started off in the enterprise realm where I was doing IT, security, engineering, and architecture. So I come from the more technical background inside of the world and did that for 12 years. Started seeing some of these recurring themes and, the way breaches are happening. And I even dealt with a handful of incidents on my own and, realized like, hey, I have this real passion for cybersecurity. So, decided to leave the enterprise life, spent the next 5 years as an independent security consultant. Most of that work I was helping with large enterprises deal with, this post-breach remediation. A lot of those attacks were coming from nation-state actors, so saw a lot of activity coming from China and Russia targeting intellectual property and financial data, and that was just a huge validator for some of these ways that attackers are coming in and exploiting companies. We talk about the nation-state as being this extremely complicated, sophisticated type of attack. The reality is they're just coming in, exploiting a lot of fundamental weaknesses that that companies have. And so that's when I realized, hey, there's a real opportunity to solve the problem around privileged accounts very differently. And that's when we started Remediant, and it's just been an amazing journey so far.
Awesome. Congratulations. Patrick, can you please go ahead and kind of introduce yourself, your bio, and how you got started in cyber? And can you tell us what was your motivating factor to initiate the DMARC initiative, please?
Absolutely. Happy to share with the audience. I stumbled into a tiny startup company
Hello?
I'm also hearing Patrick a bit muffled, so you might not be on the...
You bet. Let me try that again.
I was trying to use my good headset without success. It's great to share this with your audience. 20 years ago, I stumbled into a tiny startup company called Ironport Systems, began learning about email security, finding out it was an incredibly fertile ground for cyber criminals. After spending a decade there, building a great company and selling it to Cisco, I founded Agari because, if I'm honest, Ravi, I was fed up. Every day, it seemed like somebody would ask us a question. I sent a bunch of email out. Did the recipient receive it? Is it in their spam filter? Is it trusted? Similarly, people would get email messages and not know, is this from my bank? Is this from my social media company? And there was no way back in 2010 to know, is that a legitimate message or not? And so I was fed up enough. I decided we were going to go out and fix the internet. So I founded Agari, had a bunch of great partners, you know, Google and Microsoft and Bank of America, who are working on that DMARC standard. And we've been at it at Agari for the last 10 years, trying to make email a trusted, safe medium and take it out of hands of the criminals.
Excellent. Okay, now let's get into our show now. Caleb, what are the security trends that you've noticed since COVID-19 started? You know, when was it, back in January or February?
Sure. So, you know, some of the things that we noticed since COVID kind of been kicking in, there's been an increase with phishing attacks and people trying to get people to click on emails based upon what's going on with COVID, right? Oh, here, click on the newest trend of what's happening here, or see where COVID's really spreading rampant. People are clicking all sorts of emails and links right now. So we've seen a great amount of increase from that. We've also seen, you know, increase of attacks with BTC and trying to compromise other companies to try to get them some funding right now through, again, COVID-related emails too. So it's been a lot of that. And then all the workers right now that's been working from home, you know, it's a much harder space now to kind of protect everybody at the edge, because everyone has bringing their own device, or they're using their corporate devices and using their home internet, right? So it's a lot harder for these companies to kind of help protect their constituents at the edge. So it's been a really interesting last, you know, 4 months, just trying to help people have a better perimeter. And I know some people are trying to do that via proxying. Some are trying to do it through sandboxing. Some are, you know, trying to, you know, look for other ways around VPN to help protect their users today.
Okay. Some of the trends I've noticed, Caleb, are, I think, if there's a flip side to this, if there's any good that's come out so far, is I think business leaders, you know, especially the CIO and the CISOs, they're starting to realize the need for, you know, business continuity planning, you know, trying to use, you know, like the cloud platform, you know, like AWS or Azure, which to deploy their mobile workforce. What are your thoughts on all that?
I think that's really the trend that we're seeing right now. People are trying to figure out the risk and mitigate it as much as possible. I'm seeing also the zero trust methodology being applied a lot more to do that, right? So we want to trust but verify, you know, no matter if it's an inside user or not. So I think that's being more pertinent right now with today.
Okay. Now, the zero trust model, I have had a number of conversations with some clients about that, and I don't think the model has just came out. I think it's been around for quite some time, but zero trust, that implies that you trust nobody, right? Even if you know somebody for 10 or 15 years, there's some, and you just basically just don't trust them. Do you think the zero trust model is kind of going to an extreme? I mean, do you see it being widely deployed right now? What are your thoughts on that, please?
I think it's something that's being applied a lot more. I mean, you look at it, whether that from just even someone's credentials, right? Someone's on your network, you want to verify it, whether you're doing it through MFA or other means, to make sure that's the correct user, right? So the more layers and more challenging we can make it for attackers on the outside, you know, let's try to put those policies in place. But that just makes it harder for them, for an attacker to get in here. So I think it's always good to verify who the users are.
What kind of, in that regard, for the multi, now we're talking about, like, you know, MFA, multi-factor authentication, what are some of your more favored or more better tools that you would recommend to a client to implement for each layer that they try to protect in their lines of defense for their business? So, like, for example, at one point they may require, like, you know, the password and maybe a challenge response kind of question, and then maybe the next layer could be a biometric or something. What do you kind of recommend for that multi-tiered approach?
You know, right now what we're seeing is pretty popular is, like, some of the YubiKeys out there, or, you know, using a hardware token to verify, you know, users right now for the mobile workforce out there. We're also seeing things like people using Ping Identity, Okta, Duo, right, other MFA factors out there. But it comes from multiple layers of approach, right? That's even from, you know, someone trying to log in from a you know, domain account and trying to get access to their servers and other endpoints, right? So I think it's you know, the more layers, again, we can verify, more ways of verifying who those users are out there, It's just a better way of getting ensuring who that user is.
Now, Caleb, just a couple of questions here before we move on. I've been reading stories, and in fact, I just wrote an article for a client about the VPN. I mean, that's been a great tool, a great tried and tested tool for securing the network lines of communication from point A to point B and vice versa. But now even that's showing its vulnerabilities with, you know, the work from home stuff. Now everybody's talking about deploying the next gen VPN. What are your thoughts on that? Have you assisted clients about that, or is that something that's still that maybe the media is being too much hype about, or will the VPN still be one of the best vehicles to use for work from home? What are your thoughts on that, please?
I think VPN still is a very important part of the way that we're using to secure the workers from home today. We're seeing attackers right now trying to find more exploits and vulnerabilities within the VPN client. So we've been seeing more fixes and patches coming up as of late for that. So attackers are trying to find ways to get around that. But I think that is one of the better ways of helping secure some of the workers.
Okay. Finally, now the work from home, I mean, everybody was kind of thinking that, okay, once business is open during summertime, everybody will want to go back to work. But now I've been reading out, I just read a news article, actually, in the news that in the Bay Area, that a lot of tech startups, or even those that have a maturity level of some certain degree, they pulled their employees and all of them want to work from home for the most part. So a lot of them are now shutting down their contracts from their brick-and-mortar presence and just saying, hey, you know, instead of paying $12,000-$15,000 a month in rent, let's put that more towards innovation and, you know, helping with marketing. This work-from-home trend, do you think this is going to continue the rest of the year, even going into the next couple of years? What are your thoughts on the two?
I think at least for the near immediate future, it's going to be existing at least through end of this year. I've already talked to numerous state agencies and cities, and they're saying that at this point, their workers are not going back home till. They're not going back in the office till beginning of 2021. So, at this point, everyone's expected to continue work. Maybe they'll be in the office maybe once or twice a week, but they're mostly going to be working from home at this point.
Okay, excellent.
And I think in the near future, I think even like you see what's happening with some of the tech companies, like Facebook is saying, right? All their workers are are still being able to work efficiently. They're going to still continue working from home. So I think that model is going to change quite a bit.
Yeah, because this was a concept that nobody thought would take full 99% fruition until like 2 or 3 years out later. But, you know, as I said, one of the silver linings, I guess, of COVID, if there is one, is that we've realized it's just in a matter of like 2 or 3 months. So it's just amazing how this digital transformation just occurred in such a short period of time. But anyway, Pat, let's move on to you, please. Can you tell me more about Agari, about your company, and what about the Cosmic Links?
Sure. So here at Agari, we are very focused on phishing. And it's been remarkable, Ravi. Like, this was a problem 20 years ago, 10 years ago when I started Agari. A lot of people said, why would you spend the next decade of your life? Like, how hard can it be? Certainly email and phishing will go away. And it turns out, year after year after year, when you read the Verizon data breach report where they study the sources of data breaches, phishing is always one of the top sources. Usually 80 or 90% of data breaches are behind phishing, even though we've been working on it for 20 years. So every Agari employee, we call them Agarians, wakes up every morning trying to put an end to that plague. And to give you a sense for why it's such an amazingly difficult problem and why we're working so hard on it was the research that we just released on Cosmic Links. Now, Cosmic Links is the name we gave to a threat actor. Every 3 months or so, we release a dossier on a threat actor around the world and reveal what we can publicly about their techniques, their tips, some innovative things that they're doing that we want the security industry to understand so they can think about their defenses. And Cosmic Links was the first time we had ever seen a Russia-based BEC, business email compromise, criminal gang. Classically, we think of business email compromise as those emails that say, hey, Robbie, this is your editor. You know, you're behind on your payments. Can you send this payment? You know, can you send me that release of the press release that's coming out next week that's confidential? But, of course, that's not your CEO, your law firm, or your editor. That's someone impersonating them or compromising their email account. classically, we've seen the West African criminal gangs, Nigeria and elsewhere, this was their technique. This is what they perfected, and this is what they've spent decades from the Nigerian prince being really good at. And so when we uncovered Cosmic Links, we saw now that the Russians had gone into that financial crime business. These are the same folks who did a lot of banking malware, but they figured out, why should we do all this hard work to create malware when we can just impersonate people? And the particulars of this Cosmic Links really unveil why phishing is so difficult to stop. These cyber criminals would do research on multinationals. They would buy public data from marketing companies to understand who works for who, what their titles are, what their roles are, and then they would send a specially crafted impersonation email saying, this is your CEO, we'll call him Patrick. He is asking you to support an acquisition that's coming up, and he's going to connect you, I'm going to connect you as a CEO, to a law firm, our law firm, who's going to give you instructions. That email comes in. It's a pretty good impersonation. It's got good social engineering. And the next day, an email comes in claiming to be from the UK law firm. It's got a great bio. It's got a great LinkedIn profile telling the employee, this is confidential. We're counting on you to help with this big acquisition. It must remain secret. And then they can average cash out more than $1 million on these transactions. A very advanced form of phishing. It shows some real Russian innovation. But that's the kind of report that we released that shows how important it is to solve that problem.
Okay. Now, what can we do to help eliminate this email compromise? I mean, Pat, I know that phishing is probably, as you said, it's the oldest, probably one of the oldest forms of cyber attacks. In fact, I think the first public one was made by, it was the attack on AOL in the late 90s during the dot-com craze. And since then, phishing is just, you're right, it's the number one threat out there, and we've seen so many variants. And if you just do a simple Google search on that, there's so many tips and this and that, how to eliminate email, I mean, how to, you know, avoid phishing email. I mean, it just seems like it's getting more sophisticated day by day. In fact, even I've come close to almost being duped myself, and I've been writing about this for, you know, what, 4 years, 10 years? I mean, it's just so real. I mean, they know, I mean, the cyber tech knows how to pry upon the fears of the individual, like when it comes to saying, oh, your PayPal account's frozen, you know, somebody stole something from your credit card account or something. What can we do to eliminate all this? And it seems like the business email compromise is one of the biggest trends right now. What do you tell people to how to avoid a phishing email apart from, you know, just having the general security training? And secondly, do you think there are going to be newer threat variants coming up from phishing down the road here with COVID?
Great questions, Ravi. So let me give you my top suggestions we share with everyone out there on the internet to stay safe from these phishing. First, I want to echo what Caleb said really well earlier, two-factor authentication. That's got to be priority number one for everyone on the planet. You must have two-factor authentication. If your employees are logging in with a password, you are at high risk. You've got to have a strong two-factor authentication system. And by strong, it should not be SMS, text, or other challenge questions. It should be a modern, secure two-factor authentication. Number two is you have to understand the criminal actors. They have moved on from classic, you know, old-school phishing and malware to really advanced social engineering attacks. And so we recommend that people really educate themselves on those attacks and ensure that your email controls have strong identity protection. If you're just looking for viruses and spam and malware and malicious URLs, your company's at risk. You've got to have a modern identity-based set of email controls beyond the classic old-school ones. Third, DMARC. DMARC is an open standard. Agari was one of the pioneers of many of our industry partners. It stands for, forgive the acronym, Domain-Based Messaging Authentication Reporting and Conformance. All you have to remember, though, is DMARC. And it is a breakthrough capability. Out there on the internet, many people want to impersonate Agari or a bank or a social media company. And before DMARC, they could do so with impunity. They could send as many messages as they want to claiming to be a bank or claiming to be Agari, and there was no way to proactively stop them from hijacking that identity. DMARC is an internet-scale standard that allows an organization to secure its identity over email, prevent anyone from impersonating it, and give you threat intelligence when somebody tries to do so. So that would be my third suggestion, is to really take advantage of that technology. And then the last one I would mention is employee training. You should have the identity-based control. You should protect your identity with DMARC. You should have a modern solution in place, but you should also make sure that your employees are familiar with and aware of the threats so that they can make sure that they employ common sense, even when they're busy with end-of-the-quarter closing or shipping the latest software. That would be my fourth recommendation. And we think those will be good practices that everyone deploys to really help take a bite out of cybercrime.
Okay, excellent. Now, Pat, this is a topic I've written some articles about with my clients and blogs about what makes a good phishing security training program. Now, it's one thing to simply have a lecture for, 45 minutes and tell them what to look out for, but you really need to motivate employees, you need to use gamification techniques, but it's not a one-and-done deal. Obviously, you want to make sure that your employees will take whatever knowledge you've imparted on them, and make sure that they're going to use that to maintain a good level of cyber hygiene. And secondly, you want your training programs to go on a regular cycle to keep reinforcing what they've learned, to let them know what new is happening with threat phishing. In your view, what makes a good security training program, especially as it relates to phishing? What will motivate employees to maintain that good level of cyber hygiene based on your experience?
Yeah, great question. So, we are not a phishing training company, but we've partnered with a company called Know Before, and I have learned so much from them as we've watched our customers deploy our technologies together. What I've seen from them is, first, the training has to be customized. If you're a small 15-person nonprofit, or you're a government entity that's controlling top-secret material like the ones that Caleb works with, boy, you'd better not be sending out the same generic training. That is just a waste of their time. And so look for a partner like Know Before who can provide both a library of training and the ability to customize it so that it's relevant. I think second is, human beings are storytellers. There's a few geeky engineers out there who just want the facts, but everyone else remembers stories. They remember examples. And so some of the best phishing training out there actually has professional movie producers, professional directors, actually having stories about theft of data, cyber criminals that are engaging. You sit down for a 15-minute training, you watch 3 episodes like you binge on Netflix, and you remember it, and it's compelling storytelling. And then the third is, be consistent. If you give your employees a test or training, and then 15 months later do another one, that's almost worse than the original disease, because they're not going to remember, it's not going to be consistent. So I think if you pick someone as a partner who can help you customize the material, have really compelling original storytelling, and have a program of consistency, those would be my 3 top techniques that will be good social engineering controls for your employees that can complement the recommendations that I made earlier.
Okay, excellent. Now, Tim, let's move on to you, please. What is the difference between the traditional privilege access management solutions and how do they compare to what your company Remediant has to offer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I would say most people, when they think of privileged access management, they think of enterprise password vault. It's like, okay, we have to protect the credentials of the accounts that are sensitive. And so I think that's actually a perfect segue into how we need to change some of our foundational thinking of a privileged account and how do we actually implement effective security controls around that. Because when you hear what Caleb just spoke about around, this model of zero trust, especially if you're a large enterprise, kind of the first question is like, zero trust, this concept has been around for a while, but okay, it's great when Google released BeyondCorp, but it's one thing when you are kind of this high tech company and you have infinite amount of resources and most of your applications are done through web interface. And it's like, okay, how do you actually take that model and apply that to a large, complicated, and enterprise environment? And then taking that kind of threat model from exactly what Patrick spoke about around phishing, and now you have this workforce that has just gone completely mobile. So it's one thing when you see this phishing email come in and you look to, your coworker and they're like, hey, did you just send that? But when everyone is completely remote and you have a higher sophistication in the phishing attacks, really leads into, oh, how easy it is for attackers to compromise credentials. And so really what we're all about is, you know, coming in of this mindset, you have to assume an admin level credential is going to be compromised. And if there's any one key learning that we've had from, you know, from phishing emails is how effective they are, not just for your regular employee base, but it still applies for IT administrators. It applies to executives. And, you know, kind of, you know, really have to understand where, you know, the attackers are coming from. They're running, whether it's an organized crime or a nation state actor, they're coming in, they're running this as a regular business. They have fixed amount of time, resources, and you really have to take the easiest path to break into a particular enterprise or whatever your target is. And you're not going to spend all this time anymore on breaking through the firewall or the web application when you can start targeting the human. And that's where you've seen such a huge rise around phishing emails. So this is really kind of culminating of, okay, well, if you go in with the mindset that an admin level credential is going to be compromised, how do you implement effective security controls? And that really is two things. It's differentiating the difference between authentication versus authorization. It's like, okay, once the credential has been authenticated, where does that credential have access, especially when it comes to administrative level people? So when you take a look at, you know, your kind of your user base that has lots of IT privilege, well, it's your server admins, it's your help desk, it's, you know, business owners that have a lot of technical elements where they need administrative rights on a lot of systems. Well, this is where we come into play of, hey, the password vault doesn't really apply to those scenarios because you can have a really long, secure password, but if you get hit by a phishing link and you give those credentials away, well, then the attacker can basically access any system that isn't under direct two-factor authentication and control. So we are all about providing visibility. One is, you know, admin rights are changing all the time and making sure that you have good visibility into where any individual in the organization has administrative rights. And then tying that into this whole idea around zero standing privilege, like, hey, your IT people shouldn't have 24/7 access to everything in the infrastructure. You really want to minimize that as much as possible and then grant that on a just-in-time basis.
Okay. Now, how are your products or services effective in stopping lateral movement on a network? But before you answer that, just a question. Can you define for our audience first what is lateral movement on a network?
Yeah, that's, you know, so the idea is, you know, when you take a look at the cyber kill chain and how a company traditionally gets compromised, it's you get some sort of foothold inside of the corporate network. And this could be because you're using some credentials to either, you know, hop onto a VPN inside the network, or you have some malware that gives you a backdoor into the network. And that really becomes the first starting point. Now, where lateral movement comes in is when you can use those compromised credentials to use that same level of access to other systems on the network. And once you have your foothold and you move to your second system, once that system becomes infected, you can start harvesting other administrative credentials that are on that system. It might be local accounts, it might be other users that have logged into that system, and there's lots of very clever methods that attackers use to harvest those credentials. And once you get more and more credentials, you can then start moving around to other systems on the network, and that gives you essentially access. You go through this game of lateral movement to systems until you're going after the target. It might be financial data, it might be Active Directory, the entire user password database for the entire company. It could be intellectual property. You know, there's lots of different, you know, targets. But lateral movement is basically using compromised credentials to harvest more credentials and move around to your ultimate goal.
Okay, excellent. Now, as I just want to segue our show now into the cybersecurity threat landscape in general, and any of you could answer these next few questions. You know, we keep hearing about a lot about, you know, like nation state threat actors, you know, China, North Korea, Russia, those are the top three. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think we could see cyber attackers from other countries, or these are going to be like the top three down the road here, especially if once our presidential election comes closer to November? What are your thoughts on that, please?
I'll jump in on that. So, yes, we have been seeing this. You know, kind of the interesting thing is when you take a look at the traditional kind of you know, enterprise market. So we'll just use like the healthcare and pharmaceutical industry. It's been highly targeted by the Chinese government. Really kind of the goal is to steal the intellectual property, be able to siphon that overseas, and then they can either do this through counterfeit drugs or, you know, really reduce the costs of emerging into that entire vector. Now, taking a look at the, you know, political landscape, we definitely saw a lot of this during the 2016 elections and the activity there. There hasn't been any signs of this actually, you know, declining. We're actually starting to see a rise. And, you know, there's a lot of different avenues, right? It's one, we definitely saw a lot of activity going through the whole phishing email scheme, some high sophistication to even get around two-factor authentication. And then obviously the social media and the impact that you can have by, you know, leveraging disinformation.
Okay. Now,
great comments. And if I add to that, Ravi, Patrick Peterson here, I think we're going to see continued aggressive and even more aggressive actions by the big three, Russia, China, and Iran. Normally what we see is the degree to which they are publicly aggressive and kind of no holds barred is very much proportional to the state of our diplomatic relationship. And so if we're working, you know, in more of a partnership with these countries, they really don't want to make the other ones angry. If, on the other hand, there's a lot of conflict, you know, even headed towards something that may look like the precursor to an armed conflict, the cyber talons really come out. And so I think those three will continue to be more aggressive. Beyond that, we don't see significant nation-state cybercrime. But we do see the classic pockets of, you know, kind of West African and South American, you know, cyber criminal gangs for profit, you know, continuing to perfect their techniques and definitely taking advantage of COVID to make more money. Those are my thoughts.
Now, one of the other hot button topics in cybersecurity these days is cyber insurance policies. You know, it's, you know, like getting medical insurance or car insurance. This is a very murky area. In fact, I'm going to be writing a book on this sometime late next year with a bunch of other people. Just because an SMB thinks that they have a cyber insurance policy, then they think that they're protected financially, you know, they'll get their payout and so forth. But it's not that easy. What are your thoughts on that? And have you dealt with your clients on cyber insurance policies?
So some of the things I've just been hearing in the industry a little bit about cybersecurity insurance is we don't know if cybersecurity insurance is really going to help protect the customers out there. Reason behind is if it's a nation state that is actually attacking you, you know, some of them are saying that it's considered now as a, you know, as a terrorist attack, right? And then maybe
right.
your coverage doesn't actually protect you against that, right? So it's something that's really unknown. I mean, people are buying it right now, but we don't really know how effectively that insurance policy is going to kick in. I mean, I've heard it from some cities that have gotten compromised before. They have been protected by it, but then they weren't necessarily targeted by a nation state or, you know, specific actors like that. So it's a little bit still in the unknown on how much protection they're really going to get.
Okay.
That's a great comment, Caleb. And, if I'm honest, Ravi, I'm kind of baffled by the whole cyber insurance discussion. You know, the vast majority of cases I see have much more of a reputational and business impact than they have on a financial loss. You know, if you're a financial institution and you lose your customers' data or their money is stolen, like, you can put back the money, but you can't actually change the reputational risk that you suffer. And so, you know, there's a financial decision of should I ameliorate my risk of financial loss? But boy, if I have insurance, that doesn't mean I should go, you know, do wild and crazy things. And if I break my leg, you know, I don't suffer the impact of that. It really concerns me when people are associating cyber insurance with actually reducing your business risk as opposed to just reducing your financial risk. And then second is,
right,
even though I don't follow it that closely, I've already seen these amazing stories where the really sophisticated criminals, like the Cosmic Lynx, trick someone into wiring $5 million. And the insurance company says, that wasn't a cyber incident. Like, they didn't hack you. They didn't infiltrate your organization. They just tricked someone with social engineering into sending the money. That's not on us. And then guess what? They go spend $1 million going to court litigating it. And so far, a lot of the people with policies have not had a lot of success getting those kinds of attacks refunded to them.
So I'm kind of scratching my head and look forward to reading your book next year.
Yeah, I just want to add a little bit more to that. Some of the insurance policies even state something where if it's like gross negligence upon the customer, right, then they're not going to protect you. So, I mean, sometimes it could be a simple mistake as, you know, an admin's working on the firewall. They were opening up some ports and they forgot to close it, right? And it's something they should have closed, but they left it open, right? I mean, you know, mistakes like that happen. So, you know, at that point, you know, they consider it as gross, you know, as negligence on your part. It should have been addressed, and then they're not going to protect you because of that. So there's a lot of loopholes for those you know, insurance companies to get out of it.
Yeah, those are some really excellent points. Thank you. Now, the next other, you know, big issue right now is the Internet of Things. Now, this is obviously, you know, where everything's connected to one another, you know, in both physical and virtual worlds. And I don't like the idea of IoT. I like having things simple and not so connected, because if everything's connected, obviously we know that just increases the attack surface for the hacker. I don't have a smart home. I don't ever want to have a smart home. I still drive an old-fashioned 2003 Honda Civic. I've seen smart cars out there, you know. You just clap your hands, the car backs out, and it drives for you. What are your thoughts on the IoT? I mean, do you guys have a smart home or a smart car, and what do you think about it in general? I mean, it seems kind of scary to me.
Yeah, I think there's two things with the IoT play is, one, both, you know, how whatever IoT device is, understanding how they're handling the privacy and what information is or isn't being sent, you know, over to the company, right? So we typically think of like our Google Home or Alexa devices, and it's like, okay, are they spying on us or are they not? It's how transparent is the company being? And then the second is, okay, how are they handling the cybersecurity, the technology side of that, and making sure that, okay, if there is a vulnerability on that device, how is it being updated? How is it being patched? And really, how are you understanding your level of risk? And, you know, so for me personally, I make sure to use what I consider trusted devices that are from, you know, well-known companies that are very transparent on how they handle these things. But there's a lot of different devices, and it's really hard to actually understand what is the risk around this. And even in the enterprise world, when I was working on, you know, post-breach remediation, one of my customers, they were actually infiltrated, and they had a level of persistent because there was a compromised smart TV on their network. And just being able to track that down, it was very, very challenging. And then too, once they actually located the device, you know, they asked like, okay, well, how do we update the software and how do we know it's secure? And you know, I just turned and looked at him and I was like, don't bother with that. Just take it off the shelf and throw it in the trash can and identify all these other devices that doesn't have central management around it. You know, those are the things, especially when you're dealing with a company with lots of IoT devices, is you really have to understand and think about the management plane around these types of devices.
What makes things really interesting with some of the IoT devices out there today is, like, you know, I mean, all the new consumer stuff that's coming out, you know, that's here to try to help improve the life for the average consumer out there, right? When someone's making these devices, they really don't have a lot of times security in mind, right? So to make something hardened, it's sometimes pretty challenging, or maybe they're not going to always keep up with a firmware update. So that's something that's a big risk you have to associate. I actually had a customer that not too long ago that we discovered in their conference room that their tablet that they used for connecting all the devices in that room was compromised, and it was talking back to Russia. So, I mean, it's something that people don't really think about, right? It's like, hey, we use this device to connect all our AV equipment, but it was compromised because the password wasn't secure and it hasn't been updated in a long time. So it's hard. You know, the more devices you have, it's a bigger attack surface you have out there.
Right. If I'm correct, didn't California just like pass about a year ago or some months ago like an IoT security bill, but it was just so broad, it was kind of like poo-pooed upon by everybody?
Yeah, I mean, understanding kind of the antenna and the law, and most importantly, what is the responsibility of the company or the end user to manage security on the devices. Those are things that are pretty unclear, even just for the layman. It's like, okay, until we see some enforcement around this, and even having just a very clear standard on, okay, what is a company expected to protect versus end user? Because it's easy for a company to be like, oh, well, you didn't update the firmware, and then it becomes the end user's fault, and the end user's like, well, what is firmware, and what do I do about that, right? And that's where we really just need to make things very clear and simple for the average user.
True. One issue I've been reading about and I've been writing about is that when a customer gets an IoT device, they just use the default settings by the vendor, and they don't set to their own security requirements, which is another big security risk too. So anyway, now another hot button topic is that of artificial intelligence. Now, AI has been around since the 1950s. First originations were with the Turing test. Now we're hearing about word being bandied about quite a bit in cyber today, and AI is really used mostly for filtering for false positives, to alleviate this phenomenon called, I think, a fatigue or warning fatigue on IT security teams. It's also being used to help model the cybersecurity threat landscape. Have any of you used AI in your product and service offerings, especially, Pat, for the email stuff? I think that it's starting to be used quite a bit there too. What are your thoughts on that? Have you used it, and what do you think of it? Because it's although it has good, it also has its bad side, where the cyber attacker can actually use that to create more sophisticated threat variants.
No, that's a great question. And first, I have to say, I apologize on behalf of our industry on the massive overuse of the term. It's sad because it's such a powerful technology, and it's become so overused that it's twice as difficult for a practitioner or a buyer to actually make an assessment. But I'll share for us where it's been so powerful. Classically, cybersecurity solutions detect the bad. Is this a bad URL? Is this a bad file? Is this a series of attempted impersonation logins, those kinds of things? And those techniques have had some success. But the reality is the criminals are trying new forms of bad every day. They're coming up with files. They're uploading them to VirusTotal. They're sending them through their free Gmail accounts, their Office 365 accounts. They have test beds of all the vendors available to them in various means, and they keep on trying flavors and variants of the bad until they succeed. And then they release these, and they have minutes, hours, or days to basically unleash that variant on the bad. Now, we've made it much more difficult for them to create badness that can defeat our solutions, but they just work harder and they have more resources. And so what we've aspired to do at Agari is to do something completely different, which is to model the good. What if you knew what good email looked like? What if you knew what a good sender looked like? What if you knew at internet scale a graph of all the identity relationships so that when a bad guy came up with something new, you could simply say that deviates from the good a statistically significant enough that we're going to declare it to be not good. Now, that means you don't have to detect their latest attack du jour. You don't have to be on top of every exploit and weakness out there. You can just say, this differs from our durable model of the good. Now, that's easy to say in a podcast. The reality is modeling the internet at internet scale is phenomenally difficult. And it even changes over time, the model of the good, even if it changes orders of magnitude less than all the badness that the bad guys are trying every day. And so that's been probably our primary use of AI, artificial intelligence technology, is how do you create global models and local per customer models of email traffic at internet scale so that you can have that model of the good and every single message is mathematically analyzed against those global and local models to figure out when it goes outside the norm. And, of course, you have to update all of those models on an hourly or daily basis to keep up with changes to the good.
Okay.
I wholeheartedly agree with everything Patrick said. And I really appreciate his point around the misuse of the term AI out there, because it's one of the buzzwords that people are just like, it's really, really interesting technology, but when you start having that abuse, it's kind of out of control. And just kind of one quick point around that, especially looking at the attacker perspective, I think a really great example is the NotPetya virus, which, it leveraged kind of the initial impact into a company through an unpatched system. But the real interesting thing around that was once the system was infected, it automatically started harvesting credentials and then used those valid credentials to start propagating itself around the rest of the network. And so that model was really interesting because we never saw that level of automation around. And so I really believe that's going to be the next wave of cyber attacks, and tying all of this into AI, it's like, oh yeah, you can definitely increase the level of sophistication with this malware to use valid credentials to automatically move, whether it's a ransomware attack or a nation state attack. Just the proliferation around this is really, really important. And one of the things that we're doing on the remediant side is really taking a look at kind of the user behavior and understanding which systems are they traditionally accessing and logging into, and then how do you basically model that to know, hey, this might be whether it's an individual or an automated attack that's trying to log onto lots of different systems, and be kind of ahead of that from the defense side.
Okay. Now, one area that was a hot topic before COVID hit was that of critical infrastructure, like our water supplies, gas, oil lines, the power, national power grid. I think this country's at grave risk because we're still using old legacy systems that are air gapped, and we just can't rip out the old systems, put new ones, obviously. So we kind of have to add on layers of security, but we have to make sure that the legacy and the new stuff all integrate with each other and work well with each other. What are your thoughts on attacking critical infrastructure? Is it quite possible that we could see another like 9/11 style attack, but more on a digital edge, more so than simply seeing planes crash in buildings?
You know, I think that's something that's been talked about more
around that. Oh, Caleb, I'll let you jump in. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. I think it's something that's a big concern for a lot of security professionals out there. I mean, I know that the technology is dated. You know, people are kind of stuck in sometimes the way that they've been using, protecting their SCADA environment. So some of the technology is dated in there, or some of it's just so old that they haven't had time to even upgrade their own industrial controls. But it seems like all the new updated industrial control systems are all kind of connected. And so there is, there's a lot of concern about what's the best way to protect it. And some are trying to do it through air gaps. But I think that, I mean, some of these control systems are so old that we could very well get hit by a nationwide attacker, and if power was shut down or water was affected, I mean, it could have severe consequences. I mean, it's something that definitely does keep me up sometimes thinking about that.
Yeah, I completely agree with Caleb there. And, the important thing as you're thinking about infrastructure level of attacks is, that is really just one piece of a much larger effort at hand. And so, yes, is our infrastructure and other countries' infrastructure susceptible to cyber attacks? Absolutely. But for someone to launch a cyber attack and shut down a bunch of, power grid, that causes a lot of disruption. There's a lot of financial impact around this. But where companies are really kind of holding on to this, and a really great example is around this is during the Russia and Ukraine conflict, where, Russia was sending military troops into Ukraine. Well, that was a very highly coordinated effort with cyber attacks launched on their power grids. And so what you saw is, these power grids automatically shutting down, going through this big cyber attack as you're having military forces advance in the area. Well, now that's a huge strategic advantage from a military perspective. And I think that's exactly how companies are looking at this. It's like, okay, well, if or when there is particular conflict, how can you leverage infrastructure level cybersecurity attacks to cause additional disruption to really make it your advantage?
Okay. Now, finally, as we wrap up our show, just kind of like two questions in one. What do you think the biggest cyber threat is going to be for the remainder of the year, maybe going next? And what do you tell people to do to protect themselves? Now, obviously, we all can be a victim. We can only mitigate that risk. So do you guys have like a laundry list that you tell your clients?
So something I'll say as far as For my customers that I work with, I've been telling them that we still need to really focus a lot on security, just because, right now everybody's working remote. The attackers are not stopping, right? The attacks are increasing. And so one of the things that we've really pushed with a lot of our customers is we've been telling them, let's look at some managed security solutions, because some of them have had to cut some of their workers, and there's a shortage of security professionals out there. So, leveraging and having a company help you provides you some sort of visibility on what's going on, whether it's you know, having a SIM in place and then providing you with instant response and helping you really with that, because you got to have someone looking at your environment 24/7. So it's a recommendation that I've really pushed for all my customers to really get, you know, kind of build out a SOC as a service and find those partnerships out there that really help protect your company. You got to have a SIM in place to kind of get all the information, whether that's coming from, you know, your firewall, from your endpoints, from, you know, even from your email, right? So you got to correlate all the data and then do the investigation and then try to figure out what's actually, you know, real positive attack that's kind of happening against you. So I think that's a model that we've seen. I've had a lot of customers that sometimes are even on the smaller side. They don't have the manpower to staff for something like that. So we've been really helping with them in that manner to provide those kind of services. So that's we've seen a big uptick in that. So I mean, I think that's a continuing factor for us. I think for the rest of this year too.
Excellent. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? Or
yeah, so my thought, yeah, Ravi, is the CEO of Agari, you know, we're an email company, so my answer may be a little email-centric, but we still believe it's the number one threat vector, especially as people are working from home. They don't necessarily have the network controls, and so criminals are being more aggressive. Social engineering is the method. People should have identity-based controls in their email security stack. They should have two-factor authentication, so it's not as easy to steal those passwords. And then make sure your employees are trained so they're aware of the threats. Those are, I think, three simple basics that should be part of everyone's toolkit. Now, it won't solve all the problems in the world, but it'll help make people a lot more secure.
Excellent.
And
well,
we align really closely with – oh, yeah, I was just going to say, you know, align with the top CIS controls. You know, particularly, you know, we are obviously focused around administrative privileges. And, you know, one of the first things you have to do is understand you have to know your inventory of both your assets and where individuals have privilege to that area. And so when you take a look at these concepts of zero standing privilege, well, you know, does your IT help desk or support staff need 24/7 access to systems all the time? Well, I think the answer for us is no, because when we actually talk to individuals, they're just logging into systems at, you know, a small handful at any given moment. And the way to really approach this elegantly, what we believe in, is all around just-in-time access and making this very easy for the end user.
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to add a little bit to what Tim was saying real quick. So one of my customers, and this is kind of scary, we had an audit done recently, and we found out that they had an active session that was open for 760 days in the state agency. It was kind of mind-opening, you know, for the customer when they saw that. And, you know, that's if someone had those credentials, they could have access, you know, for a very long time. So, you know, having something like Remediant where, you know, it kind of self-terminates that session, you know, after a period of time really would help improve anybody's security posture in that way, right? So, I mean, that's something that happens all the time in test dev environments, right? I mean, people kind of forget about it, they're working on it, and then they step away for lunch, and then they maybe not even jump back in it, right? So, and to kind of touch on what Tim says, I think that is something that people need to be aware of.
Okay, excellent. Well, Tim, Patrick, and Caleb, we thank you very much for your time this afternoon. We look forward to having you back on another future podcast. It was very well informative, I think. Thank you so much for your time.
Great pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Take care. Have a great rest of the week. Take care.